1927. On October 28, the Jewish Tribune of New York states in an article, "Masonry is based on Judaism. Eliminate the teachings of Judaism from the Masonic ritual and what is left?" Also speaking on this subject, the well-known rabbi, Isaac Weiss, states Freemasonry is a Jewish establishment, whose history, grades, official appointments, passwords, and explanations are Jewish from beginning to end. 1928. William S. Paley, a Jew, founds CBS Radio and goes on to build it into a multi-billion dollar TV empire. On page 572 of June 1 St. Rothschild's own publication, La Revue de Paris, a letter to Karl Marx from Baruch Levy is reprinted, an extract of which reads as follows: "The Jewish people as a whole will be its own messiah. It will attain world dominion by the dissolution of other races, by the abolition of frontiers, the annihilation of monarchy, and by the establishment of a world republic in which the Jews will everywhere exercise the privilege of citizenship. In this new world order, the children of Israel will furnish all the leaders without encountering opposition. The governments of the different peoples forming the world republic will fall without difficulty into the hands of the Jews. It will then be possible for the Jewish rulers to abolish private property, and everywhere to make use of the resources of the state. Thus will the promise of the Talmud be fulfilled, in which is said that when the messianic time is come, the Jews will have all the property of the whole world in their hands." 1929. In April, Rothschild, Paul Warburg sends out a secret warning to his friends that a collapse and nationwide depression has been planned for later this year. It is certainly no coincidence that the biographies of all the Wall Street giants of that era, John D. Rockefeller, J. P. Morgan Jr., Joseph Kennedy, Bernard Baruch, et al., all marvel at the fact these people got out of the stock market completely just before the crash and put their assets into cash or gold. So, as all the bankers and their friends already knew, in August the Federal Reserve began to tighten the money supply. And on October 24, the big New York bankers called in their 24-hour broker call loans. This meant that both the stockbrokers and their customers had to dump their stocks on the stock market to cover their loans, irrespective of what price they had to sell them for. As a result of this, the stock market crashed, a day that would go down in history as Black Thursday. In his book, The Great Crash 1929, John Kenneth Galbraith makes the following shocking statement: "At the height of the selling frenzy, Bernard Baruch brought Winston Churchill into the visitors gallery of the New York Stock Exchange to witness the panic and impress him with his power over the wild events on the floor. Republican Congressman Louis T. McFadden, chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, from 1920 to 1931, who was a staunch critic of the Jewish bankers, is quite candid as to who was responsible when he states of this crash, it was not accidental. It was a carefully contrived occurrence. The international bankers sought to bring about a condition of despair here so that they might emerge as rulers of us all. Despite the claims of how the Federal Reserve would protect the country against depressions and inflation, they continued to further contract the money supply. Between 1929 and 1933, they would reduce the money supply by an additional 33%. Even Milton Friedman, the Nobel Peace Prize-winning economist, stated the following in a radio interview in January 1996: "The Federal Reserve definitely caused the Great Depression by contracting the amount of currency in circulation by one-third from 1929 to 1933. In only a few weeks from the day of the crash, $3 billion of wealth vanished. Within a year, $40 billion of wealth vanished. However, it did not simply disappear. It just ended up consolidated in fewer and fewer hands, as was planned. An example of this is Joseph P. Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's father. In 1929 he was worth $4 million. in 1935 following the greatest depression in America's history, that had increased to over $100 million. This is why depressions are caused. To take money out of the hands of the many for the benefit of a few. On this occasion the money would be largely spent overseas, as whilst this Great Depression was occurring, millions of American dollars was being spent on rebuilding Germany from damage sustained during World War I, in preparation for the Rothschilds' next war, World War II. Republican Louis T. McFadden, chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee from 1920 to 1931, would state the following in relation to this: after World War I, Germany fell into the hands of the German international bankers. Those bankers bought her and now they own her, lock, stock, and barrel. They have purchased her industries, they have mortgages on her soil, they control her production, they control all her public utilities. The international German bankers have subsidized the present government of Germany and they have also supplied every dollar of the money Adolf Hitler has used in his lavish campaign to build up a threat to the government of Brüning. When Brüning fails to obey the orders of the German international bankers, Hitler is brought forth to scare the Germans into submission. Through the Federal Reserve Board, over $30 billion of American money has been pumped into Germany. You have all heard of the spending that has taken place in Germany. Modernistic dwellings, her great planetariums, her gymnasiums, her swimming pools, her fine public highways, her perfect factories. All this was done on our money. All this was given to Germany through the Federal Reserve Board. The Federal Reserve Board has pumped so many billions of dollars into Germany that they dare not name the total. Interestingly, the money pumped into Germany to build her up in preparation for World War II is into the German Thyssen banks, which are affiliated with the Rothschild-controlled Harriman interest in New York. 1930. This year, 33 years after the first World Zionist Congress was held in Basel, Switzerland, the first Rothschild World Bank, the Bank for International Settlements, BIS, is established in the same place, Basel, Switzerland. It is established by Charles G. Dawes, Rothschild agent and vice president under President Calvin Coolidge from 1925 to 1929, Owen D. Young, Rothschild agent, founder of Car and chairman of General Electric from 1922 until 1939, and Jamar Schacht of Germany, president of the Reichsbank. The BIS is referred to by the bankers as the central bank for the central banks. To put this bank into perspective today, whereas the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank deal with governments, the BIS deals only with other central banks. All its meetings are held in secret and involve the top central bankers from around the world. For example, the former head of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, would go to the BIS headquarters in Basel, Switzerland, 10 times a year for these private meetings. The BIS also has the status of a sovereign power and is immune from governmental control. A summary of this immunity is listed below. 1. Diplomatic immunity for persons and what they carry with them, that is diplomatic pouches. 2. No taxation on any transactions, including salaries paid to employees. 3. Embassy-type immunity for all buildings and/or offices operated by the BIS worldwide, including China and Mexico. 4. No oversight or knowledge of operations by any government authority, they are not audited. 5. Freedom from immigration restrictions. 6. Freedom to encrypt any and all communications of any sort. 7. Freedom from any legal jurisdiction, they even have their own police force. Georgetown professor and historian, Carol Quigley, commented on the creation of this central bank in his 1975 book, Tragedy and Hope, as follows: the powers of financial capitalism had a far-reaching plan nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert, by secret agreements arrived at in frequent meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world. A handful of United States senators led by Henry Cabot Lodge would fight to keep the United States out of the Bank for International Settlements. However, even though the United States rejected this world central bank, the Federal Reserve still sent members to participate in its meetings in Switzerland, right up until 1994, when the United States was, officially, dragged into it. 1931. This year, United States State Department papers come to light of the following. In 1917, during the Russian Revolution, M. Dendijk, the Netherlands minister in Russia at the time, informed various governments, including Britain, France, and the United States, of the danger of communism, which he identified as overtly Jewish, when he sent them a communique, a segment of which states, "The danger is now so great that I feel it my duty to call the attention of the British and all other governments to the fact that if an end is not put to Bolshevism in Russia at once, the civilization of the whole world will be threatened. This is not an exaggeration. I consider that the immediate suppression of Bolshevism is the greatest issue now before the world, not even excluding the war which is still raging, and unless, as above stated, Bolshevism is nipped in the bud immediately, it is bound to spread in one form or another over Europe and the whole world, as it is organized and worked by Jews who have no nationality and whose one object is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things." Prominent member of the Jewish Alliance Israelite Universelle, Jeannie Zulet, states, "This year the meaning of the history of the last century is that today 300 Jewish financiers, all masters of lodges, rule the world." 1933. On January 30, Adolf Hitler becomes Chancellor of Germany. He expels the Jews as communists out of all governmental positions within Germany. Interestingly, at the time the number of Jews in Germany's government was over 20 times those in their government since the end of World War I. As a result of this expulsion, in July, the Jews hold a world conference in Amsterdam, during which they demand that Hitler reinstate every Jew back to his former position. Hitler refuses, and as a result of this, Samuel Untermeyer, the Ashkenazi Jew who blackmailed President Wilson, and is now the head of the American delegation and the president of the whole conference, returns to the United States, and makes a speech on radio which was transcribed in the New York Times, on Monday, August 7, 1933. In the speech he made the following statements: "The Jews are the aristocrats of the world. Our campaign is the economic boycott against all German goods, shipping and services. What we are proposing is to prosecute a purely defensive economic boycott that will undermine the Hitler regime and bring the German people to their senses by destroying their export trade, on which their very existence depends. Each of you, Jew and Gentile alike, must refuse to deal with any merchant or shopkeeper who sells any German-made goods or who patronizes German ships or shipping. Two-thirds of Germany's food supply would have to be imported, and could only be imported with the proceeds of what they exported, so if Germany could not export, two-thirds of Germany's population would starve, as there would be not enough food for more than one-third of the population. Nevertheless, Jews throughout America participate in this boycott, protesting outside and damaging any stores in which they found any products with 'Made in Germany' printed on them, causing stores to have to dump these products or risk bankruptcy. Once the effects of this boycott began to be felt in Germany, the Germans began boycotting Jewish stores in the same way the Jews had done to stores selling German products in America. The Nazis and the Jews in Palestine collaborate, as they would for the next 7 years. This is because they essentially wanted the same thing. The Jews in Palestine wanted all the Jews to live in Palestine, and the Nazis wanted all Jews out of Germany. Both sides therefore sign a transfer agreement known as Havara, which permitted the transfer of Jews and all their capital from Germany to Palestine. As a result of this agreement, 60,000, approx 20% of Germany's Jews, emigrate to Palestine, and make up 15% of the Jewish population there by 1939. They take with them $40 million of assets, worth approximately $600 million today, with the blessing of the Nazi regime. According to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, by September 1939, approximately 282,000 Jews had left Germany and 117,000 from annexed Austria. Of these, some 95,000 emigrated to the United States, 60,000 to Palestine, 40,000 to Great Britain, and about 75,000 to Central and South America, with the largest numbers entering Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and Bolivia. More than 18,000 Jews from the German Reich were also able to find refuge in Shanghai, in Japanese-occupied China. At the end of 1939, about 202,000 Jews remained in Germany and 57,000 in annexed Austria, many of them elderly. Interestingly, all of these Jews who left Germany voluntarily before the Second World War even started, will go on to be known as Holocaust survivors, and entitled to reparation payments following the end of the Second World War. This is because the definition of a Holocaust survivor is as follows: any Jew who lived in a country at the time when it was 1. Under Nazi regime, 2. Under Nazi occupation, or 3. Under regime of Nazi collaborators, as well as any Jew who fled due to the above regime or occupation. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a Sephardic crypto-Jew, real name Rosenfeld, orders the all-seeing eye to be placed upon all new dollar bills, along with the motto, Novus Ordo Seclorum. This is Latin for, a new order of the ages, or as more commonly stated today, New World Order. Furthermore, on November 16, President Roosevelt recognizes the Bolshevik regime of Stalin in Russia without consultation with Congress, whilst 8,000 Ukrainians march in protest in New York. Roosevelt would never admit his Jewish ancestry, but he would go further than most. In the New York Times of March 14, 1935, he is quoted with the following statement: in the distant past, my ancestors may have been Jews. All I know about the origin of the Roosevelt family is that they are apparently descendants of Claes Martens and Van Roosevelt, who came from Holland. In his book, From Pharaoh to Hitler, What is a Jew?, Jewish author Bernard Joseph Brown admits that since the Jews of today are not Israelites, they have no claim to the land of Palestine. On May 11, Haim Nachman Bialik, a Jewish poet, widely recognized as Israel's national poet, in an address given to Jews at the Jewish University in Jerusalem, states, not in vain have Jews been drawn to journalism. In their hands it became a mighty weapon, highly fitted to meet their needs in their war of survival. 1934. In January, staunch Zionist Vladimir Jabotinsky gives an update on Samuel Untermeyer's boycott of Germany when he makes the following statement: the fight against Germany has now been waged for months by every Jewish community, on every conference, in all labor unions, and by every single Jew in the world. There are reasons for the assumption that our share of this fight is of general importance. We shall start a spiritual and material war of the whole world against Germany. Germany is striving to become once again a great nation and to recover her lost territories as well as her colonies. but our Jewish interests call for the complete destruction of Germany. Collectively and individually, the German nation is a threat to us Jews. Swiss banking secrecy laws are reformed and it becomes an offense, resulting in imprisonment for any bank employee to violate bank secrecy. This is all in preparation for the Rothschild-engineered Second World War, in which, as usual, they will fund both sides. In its June 20th issue, New Britain Magazine of London publishes a statement made by former British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, in which he states that Britain is the slave of an international financial bloc. The article also contains the following words written by Lord Bryce: "Democracy has no more persistent and insidious foe than money power. Questions regarding Bank of England, its conduct and its objects, are not allowed by the Speaker of the House of Commons." In his book, Jews Must Live, published this year, Jewish writer Samuel Roth states of the Jews: "Our major vice of old, as of today, is parasitism. We are a people of vultures living on the labor and the good nature of the rest of the world. But, despite our faults, we would never have done so much damage to the world if it had not been for our genius for evil leadership. Granted our parasitism." Edmund de Rothschild dies. 1935. Between 1930 and 1935, Elizabeth Dunn publishes her four-volume set, Documents Illustrative of the History of the Slave Trade to America. This shows that Jews totally dominated the trade in African slaves to America, and at least 15 of the ships used to transport the slaves were owned by Jews, some of whom had clear and close ties to the Rothschilds. In order to deceive the authorities that no Jews were involved, they often would use an all-Gentile crew and captain. On November 6, Mao Zedong states all political power comes from the barrel of a gun. The Communist Party must command all the guns. That way, no guns can ever be used to command the party. Subsequently, from 1948 to 1952, 20 million political dissidents are rounded up and exterminated as they are unable to defend themselves from the communists and China due to Mao Zedong's gun control laws. 1936. With regard to the increase in anti-Semitism in Germany, Samuel Landmann, at the time secretary to the World Zionist Organization, in his 1936 book, Great Britain, the Juice, and Palestine, states the following of the United States' entry into World War I: "The fact that it was Jewish help that brought USA into the war on the side of the Allies has rankled ever since in German, especially Nazi, minds, and has contributed in no small measure to the prominence which anti-Semitism occupies in the Nazi program." On October 3, Republican Congressman Louis T. McFadden, chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, from 1920 to 1931, is poisoned to death. This is the third assassination attempt on his life. He had suffered an earlier poisoning and had had shots fired at him. McFadden had been one of the staunchest critics of the Federal Reserve and the Jewish criminal cabal behind it. 1937. In his book, Stalin, Trotsky, or Lenin, George Marlin states, if the tide of history does not turn toward communist internationalism, then the Jewish race is doomed. In other words, he's saying that the Jews are totally in charge of communist internationalism, and if the world does not turn to a new world order of Jewish communist internationalism, then the Jewish race is doomed. Interestingly, internationalism is an early incarnation of globalization. Another writer, William Joyce, an Englishman, so disgusted with Britain's subservience to the Jews that he would defect to Germany just before World War II, and broadcast a radio program from there trying to wake up the British people to the enemy in their midst, stated, "This year Britain and Germany, particularly with the assistance of Italy, can form against Bolshevism and international finance, twin Jewish manifestations, a bulwark much too strong to invite attack. International finance is controlled by great Jewish moneylenders, and communism is being propagated by Jewish agitators who are at one fundamentally with the powerful capitalists of their race in desiring an international world order, which would, of course, give universal sovereignty to the only international race in existence. Indeed, on February 4, renowned historian Hilaire Belloc makes the following statement in G.K.'s Weekly: "The propaganda of communism throughout the world, in organization and direction, is in the hands of Jewish agents. As a for anyone who does not know that the Bolshevist movement in Russia is Jewish, I can only say that he must be a man who is taken in by the suppression of our deplorable press." This year, Professor Ray Kulisher, a Jew, calls for the genocide of all Germans to be the priority of worldwide Jewry when he states Germany is the enemy of Judaism and must be pursued with deadly hatred. "The goal of Judaism today is a merciless campaign against all German peoples and the complete destruction of the nation. We demand a complete blockade of trade, the importation of raw materials stopped, and retaliation towards every German, woman and child." On April 28, in an article published in the Daily Express, 27-year-old Lord Victor Rothschild also demonstrates how prophetic he is when asked by reporter W. Hickey where he intended to live when the lease on his Piccadilly home ran out. He replied, "Nowhere probably, I just don't know. Not till after the war anyway. It would be 2.5 years before World War II would start, yet, naturally, he already knew the war was coming." On October 30, Rear Admiral Henry Hamilton Beamish stated the following to an assembly in New York in 1848: "The word anti-Semitic was invented by the Jews to prevent the use of the word Jew. The right word for them is Jew. I implore all of you to be accurate, call them Jews. There is no need to be delicate on this Jewish question. You must face them in this country. The Jew should be satisfied here. I was here 47 years ago, your doors were thrown open to the Jews and they were free. Now he has got you absolutely by the throat, that is your reward." 1938. On January 1, Nesta Webster publishes her book, Germany and England, in which she states England is no longer controlled by Britons. "We are under the invisible Jewish dictatorship, a dictatorship that can be felt in every sphere of life." On November 7, a Jew, Herschel Greenspan, assassinates Ernst Vomt, a minor official at the German embassy in Paris. In December, Sir Oswald Mosley makes the following revealing statement on the allegation that the Jews are being persecuted in Germany: "Supposing that every allegation were true. Supposing it was a fact that a minority in Germany were being treated as the papers allege, was that any reason for millions in Britain to lose their lives in a war with Germany? How many minorities had been badly treated in how many countries since the war without any protest from press or politicians? Why was it only when Jews were the people affected that we had any demand for war with the country concerned? There was only one answer. That today Jewish finance controlled the press and political system of Britain. If you criticize a Jew at home, then jail threatens you. If others touch a Jew abroad, then war threatens them." Rabbi Stephen Wise, the president of both the American Jewish Congress and the World Jewish Congress, puts forward his expectations of the Jews' loyalty to his country of domicile when he makes the following statement to a rally in New York: "I am not an American citizen of the Jewish faith. I am a Jew. I am an American. I have been an American for 63/64 of my life, but I have been a Jew for 4,000 years. Hitler was right in one thing. He calls the Jewish people a race, and we are a race." 1939. I.G. Farben, the leading producer of chemicals in the world and largest German producer of steel, dramatically increases its production. This increased production is almost exclusively used to arm Germany for World War II. This company is controlled by the Rothschilds and goes on to use Jews and other disaffected peoples as slave labor in concentration camps. Interestingly, I.G. Farben also created Zyklon B gas that it will be alleged was used to exterminate Jews. In Germany, Hitler had been doing phenomenally well in turning his country around economically ever since he came to power. He did this by breaking with the Jewish international bankers, and trading by barter, thus bartering the surplus of goods Germany had, with the surplus of goods Germany needed that another country had, without debts being incurred on either side. He, like Abraham Lincoln before him, simply issued what money was needed on the authority of the German government, which was backed by the productivity of the German labor force, and not the empty promises of Jewish international bankers, who in a country without debt, could not function. As a result of this policy, Germany was able to regenerate the social and spiritual life of all its citizens. Put simply, when you are able to help your people, the people in turn help you, as they are of course happy because they are being respected, and are thus able to respect themselves. As a result of a Germany being run for the benefit of the Germans as opposed to for the benefit of Jewish bankers, the citizens of Germany were able to make Germany the most powerful and prosperous state in Europe in only a 7-year period. An example of how Hitler achieved this is recorded in William Gailey Simpson's 1978 book, Which Way Western Man, in which he states the German peasant, who had been on the verge of utter ruin, was given an honored status as the source of the nation's food supply. His land was released from the grip of the Jewish usurer and measures taken to ensure that it should remain permanently in the possession of one family, handed down from father to son. The Jews could not let this continue, as they knew that it would spell the death of their debt-driven money system, and so World War II starts this year, in earnest. This war is about one thing: which money system would survive. This is not a war between Germany and the Allies, it is a war between Germany and the Jewish money power, who are in control of the Allied leadership and use them and their media to propagandize the Allied populace into hatred of the Germans. On May 22, Anthony Crossley, Conservative MP for Oldham, makes the following statement in the House of Commons in relation to the plight of the Arabs as a result of Jewish persecution of the Arabs in Palestine. I do not believe that there has ever been a debate in this House, when this House would have been more justified in calling to the bar an Arab speaker to explain the Arab point of view from the viewpoint of his own countrymen and his own country. There are no Arab members of Parliament. There are no Arab constituents to bring influence to bear upon their members of Parliament. There is no Arab control of newspapers in this country. It is impossible almost to get a pro-Arab letter into the Times. There are in the city no Arab financial houses who control large amounts of finance. There is no Arab control of newspaper advertisements in this country. There are no Arab ex-colonial secretaries who one by one get up and thunder, as they will, at the government during the debate, because of the mistakes they themselves have made in the past. Finally, and I want the colonial secretary to pay special attention to this point, tomorrow night there is to be a broadcast. There is to be himself giving the government point of view. There is to be the honorable member for the Don Valley to advance what is obviously the Zionist point of view. There is to be the honorable member for Carnarvon Boroughs supporting the Zionist point of view. There will not be a supporter of the Arabs who can advance their point of view. On August 15, less than 3 months later, Anthony Crossley will be killed in action off the coast of Denmark, having joined the British armed forces soon after the outbreak of World War II. 1940. Hans Jürgen Kohler, in his book Inside the Gestapo, states the following of Maria Anna Sigruber, Adolf Hitler's grandmother, a little servant girl. Came to Vienna and became a domestic servant. At the Rothschild mansion. And Hitler's unknown grandfather must be probably looked for in this magnificent house. This is reiterated by Walter Langer in his book, The Mind of Hitler, in which he states Adolf's father, our Hitler, was the illegitimate son of Maria Anna Sigruber. Maria Anna Sigruber was living in Vienna at the time she conceived. At that time she was employed as a servant in the home of Baron Rothschild. As soon as the family discovered her pregnancy, she was sent back home. Where Auwa was born. The idea that Hitler could have been a Rothschild illegitimate seems ridiculous. However, it cannot be denied that one of Hitler's major successes had been the emigration of Jews to Palestine, something which was also one of the Rothschilds' main aims. The Rothschilds knew that a country without a population would be meaningless. Furthermore, the propaganda the Jews got out of the Second World War advanced the Rothschilds' program of Jewish supremacism more significantly than any other event in history. This year, William Joyce, living in self-imposed exile in Germany, publishes his book, Twilight Over England, in which he states of the Jewish character adamantine materialism, a flair for assuming mysticism outwardly, a supreme contempt for other races, a complete disregard for other people's rights, cleverness in imitation and improvisation, contempt for all labor not associated with high profits, great energy in the cause of money-making, a hatred of all nationalism but their own, a high degree of loyalty to their own family and their own community, an implicit faith in the power to corrupt Gentiles, a brilliant capacity for intrigue, and a pathetic inability to keep pace with any deeper thought or higher idealism are the chief characteristics of the Jewish race. On all these attributes, volumes could be written, but it should suffice to express the resultant of these forces very simply in the following tendencies. 1. An inability to avoid forming a state within a state. 2. Complete inability to view their Gentile hosts as possessing equal rights with their own. 3. Predetermined specialization in all those processes which bring high profit. Hence, in capitalism, almost exclusive preoccupation with finance, distribution, and exchange as distinct from productive industry. Professional work undertaken either for profit or for the sake of social advancement. 4. A natural tendency to utilize social and economic advancement for the purpose of gaining political power. 5. An unholy dread of nationalism as a factor which would draw attention to their racial nature and expose their operations. 6. The deliberate debasement of the standards of culture in the land of their sojourn. 7. The elimination by competition of the Aryan who merely wants to get enough for himself and not more than anybody else. These resultants seem to manifest themselves in every land that the Jew inhabits. 1941. President Roosevelt takes America into the Second World War by refusing to sell Japan any more steel scrap or oil. Japan is in the midst of a war against China, and without that scrap steel and oil, Japan knows they will be unable to continue that war. Roosevelt in turn knows this economic boycott would provoke the Japanese to attack America, which they subsequently did at Pearl Harbor. Interestingly, back in 1939, President Roosevelt tried his hardest to railroad the United States into the war in Europe to accommodate the Jews in the United States and the world, but when that failed, he knew he would have to try a different tactic. That was, of course, what happened at Pearl Harbor. Sir Josiah Stamp, director of the Bank of England during the years 1928 to 1941, makes the following statement with regard to banking. The modern banking system manufactures money out of nothing. The process is perhaps the most astounding piece of sleight of hand that was ever invented. Banking was conceived in iniquity and born in sin. Bankers own the earth. Take it away from them, but leave them the power to create money, and with the flick of the pen they will create enough money to buy it back again. Take this great power away from them and all great fortunes like mine will disappear, and they ought to disappear, for then this would be a better and happier world to live in. But if you want to continue to be slaves of the banks and pay the cost of your own slavery, then let bankers continue to create money and control credit. 1942. Prescott Bush, father and grandfather of future American presidents George Herbert Walker and George W. respectively, has his company seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act. He had been funding Hitler from America, whilst American soldiers were being killed by German soldiers. Interestingly, the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, never criticizes any of the Bush family for this. On May 8, the Jewish Chronicle runs an editorial in which they state boastfully, "We have been at war with Hitler since the first day that he gained power." Indeed, on December 3, Chaim Weizmann, president of the World Jewish Congress, makes the following statement in New York: "We are not denying and we are not afraid to confess, this war is our war and that it is waged for the liberation of Jewry. Stronger than all fronts together is our front, that of Jewry. We are not only giving this war our financial support on which the entire war production is based. We are not only providing our full propaganda power, which is the moral energy that keeps this war going. The guarantee of victory is predominantly based on weakening the enemy forces, on destroying them within their own country, within the resistance. And we are the Trojan horse in the enemy's fortress. Thousands of Jews living in Europe constitute the principal factor in the destruction of our enemy. There, our front is a fact and the most valuable aid for victory." Leonard Goldenson founds the ABC television network and as president oversees ABC's success. 1943. February 18, Zionist Isaac Greenbaum, head of the Jewish Agency Rescue Committee, in a speech to the Zionist Executive Council states, "If I am asked, could you give from the United Jewish Appeal monies to rescue Jews, I say, no, and I say again no." He goes on to state, "One cow in Palestine is worth more than all the Jews in Poland." This is not a surprise, as Zionism and Nazism had similar aims. They both wanted the Jews out of Germany. However, the Zionists were not interested in any Jews that didn't want to go to Palestine and thought it would be more beneficial to ensure these Jews be placed in concentration camps, in order to frighten Jews worldwide into fleeing to Palestine, which they touted as the only state where they could be safe. 1944. On November 6, Lord Moyne, British minister resident in the Middle East, is assassinated in Cairo by two members of the Jewish terrorist group, the Stern Gang, led by future Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Shamir. He is also responsible for an assassination attempt against Harold McMichael, the High Commissioner of the British Mandate of Palestine, this same year. Interestingly, he also masterminds another successful assassination this year against the United Nations representative in the Middle East, Count Folke Bernadotte, although he had secured the release of 21,000 prisoners from German camps during World War II, was seen by Yitzhak Shamir and his terrorist collaborators as an anti-Zionist. In Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank, initially called the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development or IBERD, the name World Bank was not actually adopted until 1975, are approved with full United States participation. The principal architects of the Bretton Woods system, and hence the IMF, are Harry Dexter White and John Maynard Gaines. Interestingly, Harry Dexter White, who died in 1946, would be identified as a Soviet spy whose code name was Jurist on October 16, 1950, in an FBI memo, and as for John Maynard Gaines, he is British. What the IMF and World Bank essentially did was repeat on a world scale what the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 had established in the United States. They created a banking cartel comprising the world's privately owned central banks, which gradually assumed the power to dictate credit policies to the banks of all nations. In the same way, the Federal Reserve Act authorized the creation of a new national fiat currency called Federal Reserve Notes. The IMF has been given the authority to issue a world fiat money called Special Drawing Rights, or SDRs. Member nations would end up being pressured into making their currencies fully exchangeable for SDRs. The IMF is controlled by its board of governors, which are either the heads of different central banks, or the heads of the various national treasury departments who are dominated by their central banks. Also, the voting power in the IMF gives the United States and the United Kingdom, the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England, effective overall control of it. 1945. On July 16, the first successful test of the atomic bomb occurs at the Trinity site, 200 miles south of Los Alamos. Its creator, J. Robert Oppenheimer, a Rothschild, states in Wonder I Am Become Death, the Destroyer of Worlds. He is right. Within the month, subsequent detonations over Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan result in the deaths of 140,000 people in Hiroshima and 80,000 in Nagasaki. The end of World War II. It is reported that the Rothschild-controlled IG Farben plants were specifically not targeted in the bombing raids on Germany. Interestingly, at the end of the war, whilst parts of Germany lay in ruins, they were found to have only sustained 15% damage. The tribunals held at the end of the Second World War, to investigate Nazi war crimes, censor any materials recording Western assistance to Hitler, such as that of Prescott Bush. The Rothschilds take a giant step towards their goal of world domination when their third overt attempt at world government, the Second League of Nations, which is called the United Nations, is approved this year. 1946. On January 3, William Joyce is executed. As he awaits his execution, he makes his last statement in death as in this life, "I defy the Jews who caused this last war, and I defy the power of darkness which they represent. I warn the British people against the aggressive imperialism of the Soviet Union. May Britain be great once again, and, in the hour of the greatest danger to the West, may the standard of the Heidenkreuz, swastika, be raised from the dust, crowned with the historic words, 'Ihr habt doch gesiegt,' you have actually won. I am proud to die for my ideals, and I am sorry for the sons of Britain who have died without knowing why." On February 12, the British security services receive a telegram from a reliable source in Palestine claiming that the Stern Gang are training members to go to England to assassinate members of His Majesty's government, especially Mr. Bevin, British Foreign Minister Ernest Bevin. On July 22, the future Prime Minister of Israel, Ashkenazi Jew, David Ben-Gurion, orders another future Prime Minister of Israel, Ashkenazi Jew, Menachem Begin, to carry out a terrorist attack on the King David Hotel in Palestine, to try and drive out the British. As a result of this, 91 people are killed, most of them civilians, 41 Arabs, 28 British, 17 Jews, and 5 others. Around 45 people are injured. When he was asked by prominent journalist Russell Warren Howe if he considered himself the father of terrorism in the Middle East, Menachem Begin proudly replied, "No, in the entire whole world." 60 years later, on July 22, 2006, another future Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, together with many other Israeli government representatives, dedicate a plaque at the site of this terrorist atrocity, which cites the bombers as freedom fighters to be admired by Israel. Just to put the gravity of the attack on the King David Hotel into perspective, it was at the time the biggest death toll as a result of single terrorist action ever, and was only surpassed nearly 40 years later by the bombing of the United States barracks in Beirut in 1982. The Bank of England is nationalized, which means that the state acquired all the shares in the Bank of England, which now belong to the Treasury and are held in trust by the Treasury solicitor. However, as the government has no money to pay for the shares, they give the current secret shareholders of the Bank of England government stocks instead of money for their shares. This means that although the state now receives the operating profits of the bank, this gain is largely offset by the fact that the government now has to pay interest on the new stocks it has issued to pay for the shares. So, although the Bank of England is now state-owned, the fact is that the British money supply is still almost entirely in private hands. with 97% of it being in the form of interest-bearing loans of one sort or another, created by private commercial banks. As a result of this, the bank is largely controlled and run by those from the world of commercial banking and conventional economics. The members of the Court of Directors, who set policy and oversee its functions, are drawn almost entirely from the world of banks, insurance, economists and big business, and of course a Rothschild continues to sit on its board. Although the Bank of England is called a central bank, it is now essentially a regulatory body that supports and oversees the existing system. It is sometimes referred to as the lender of last resort, insofar as one of its functions as the banker's bank is to support any bank or financial institution that gets into difficulties and suffers a run on its liquid assets. Interestingly, in these circumstances, it is not obliged to disclose details of any such measures, the reason being so as to avoid a crisis in confidence. 1947. The British, who prior to World War II declared that there would be no more immigration of Jews to Palestine in order to protect the Palestinians from their acts of terror against both them and British soldiers, transfer control of Palestine to the United Nations. The United Nations resolved to have Palestine partitioned into two states, one Jewish and one Arab, with Jerusalem to remain as an international zone to be enjoyed by all religious faiths. This transfer is scheduled to take place on May 15, 1948. However, just to put into perspective who controls the United Nations, please be aware that the UN had no right to give Arab property to anyone. As indeed, even though the Jews owned only 6% of Palestine at the time, Resolution 181 granted the Jews 57% of the land, leaving the Arabs, who at that time had 94%, with only 43%. Terror attacks against the British in Palestine continued. In fact, during the summer, three Jewish terrorists, Jacob Weiss, Mran Nakar, and Avshalom Habib, found guilty of an attack on Acre Jail on May 4th. Were to be hanged. At the same time, the Airgun terrorist gang headed by future Prime Minister Menachem Begin were holding two British sergeants, Mervyn Pse and Clifford Martin, as hostages for the three Jewish terrorists. Indeed, Begin stated, "We will hang the British sergeants at exactly the same time as our men die." The executions of the Jewish terrorists took place, and the British sergeants were found executed also, hanging from two eucalyptus trees. Captain D. H. Galati of 23rd Field Squadron, Royal Engineers, cut down one of the bodies only to be seriously injured by an explosion. Unsatisfied with killing these British soldiers, the Jews had booby-trapped their corpses. Interestingly, a popular British newspaper, the Daily Express, carried as their lead story a large picture of these soldiers strung up in the trees, but this front page has now been deleted from the Daily Express archives. The owner of the Daily Express, Richard Desmond, a Jewish pornographer. Information collected by the Anti-Defamation League, AD, in its spy operations on United States citizens is used by the House Select Committee on Un-American Activities. Subcommittee Chair, Claire Hoffman, dismisses the AD's reports on suspected communists as hearsay. In October, Ashkenazi Jew Albert Einstein writes an open letter to the United Nations encouraging all national governments to be destroyed to make way for a one-world government to be run by the UN. In his diary of July 21, President Harry S. Truman makes the following entry: "The Jews have no sense of proportion, nor do they have any judgment on world affairs. The Jews, I find, are very, very selfish. They care not how many Estonians, Latvians, Finns, Poles, Yugoslavs or Greeks get murdered or mistreated as post-war displaced persons, as long as the Jews get special treatment. Yet when they have power, physical, financial or political, neither Hitler nor Stalin has anything on them for cruelty or mistreatment to the underdog." 1948. In the spring of this year, the Rothschilds bribe President Harry S. Truman, 33rd President of the United States 1945-1953, to recognize Israel as a sovereign state with $2 million which they give to him on his campaign train. At midnight on May 14, the State of Israel is officially proclaimed in Tel Aviv. 11 minutes later, President Truman declares the United States as the first foreign nation to recognize it. Truman later confides to friends that he wanted to recognize the Jewish state in the first hour of its birth, yet when pressed by journalists on this subject, he refuses to discuss his pro-Jewish stance any further. The flag of Israel is unveiled. The emblem on the flag is a blue-colored version of the Rothschild red hexagram. It has a blue border at the top and the bottom which represents the Nile and Euphrates rivers. This is put there to make the Jewish territorial ambitions very clear, and Israel in accordance with its biblical borders. This would of course mean the inclusion into Israel of Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and parts of Saudi Arabia. This use of the Rothschild hexagram is disguised as it is referred to in the Rothschild media as a Star of David. However, it is clear to anyone with knowledge of esoteric symbolism that this hexagram was used in the ancient mystery religions as the symbol of Mush, described as a demon of unwilling sacrifice, and is also interestingly the name of the stone owl, the elite worship at Bohemian Grove, and Astaroth, described as the Lord Treasurer of Hell. Due to the fact it is made up of six lines, has six triangular sectors and six points, it is commonly regarded as a symbol of Satan. Interestingly, the hexagram is also used to represent Saturn, which has been identified as the esoteric name for Satan. Would this not indicate that anyone killed in the name of Israel is actually a sacrifice to their god, Satan? Furthermore, the Jewish Sabbath is on Saturday, which was originally known as Saturn's Day. So, to recap, the hexagram on the Israeli flag represents the number of the beast 666. It is an ancient representation of Satan, also known as Saturn, and the Jewish weekly religious day is Saturn's Day. In the early hours of April 19, 132 Jewish terrorists from the Agon Gang, led by future Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, and the Stern Gang, led by future Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, brutally massacre 200 men, women and children as they are sleeping peacefully in the Arab village of Deir Yassin. In an effort to prevent outside observers discovering the brutality of their war crimes, they try to burn some of the bodies, but when that proves unsatisfactory, they stuff some in a well to hide them from the Red Cross representatives who arrive on the scene the next day and would subsequently tell the world. Indeed, reports from survivors can be found in the report of the Criminal Investigation Division, a Palestine government document labeled No. 179/110/17/GS dated April 13, 15, and 16, 1948, in which British interrogating officer, Assistant Inspector General Richard Catling states the recording of statements is hampered also by the hysterical state of the women, who often break down many times, whilst the statement is being recorded. There is, however, no doubt that many sexual atrocities were committed by the attacking Jews. Many young schoolgirls were raped and later slaughtered. Old women were also molested. One story is current concerning a case in which a young girl was literally torn in two. Many infants were butchered and killed. I also saw one old woman who gave her age as 104, who had been severely beaten about the head with rifle butts. Women had bracelets torn from their arms and rings from their fingers, and parts of some women's ears were severed in order to remove earrings. As a result of this, the Jews go on to detest the Red Cross, which is why, in the future, they always block them entering any territory in which they are involved in conflict, for as long as possible, to give them time to clean up evidence of their criminal acts. Following the United Nations transfer of Palestine to an independent Jewish state and an independent Arab state on May 15, the Israelis launch another military assault on the Arabs, today known as Palestinians, with blaring loudspeakers on their trucks informing the Arabs that if they do not flee immediately, they will be slaughtered. 800,000 Arabs with the recent memory of the Deir Yassin massacre at the forefront of their minds, flee in panic. They ask for help from neighboring Arab states, but those states do not get involved as they are no match for the Israelis whose up-to-date military hardware had been supplied by the Jewish Stalinist regime in Russia. Following this series of Jewish genocidal war crimes, the Jews now control 78% of the former Palestine as opposed to the 57% that had already been given to them illegally by the Jewish-controlled United Nations. The Arabs, many of them Christians, would never be paid compensation for their homes, property and businesses stolen from them during this genocide, and as a result these people end up in slum refugee cities of tents. Furthermore, at least half of the Arabs, in a desperate hurry to flee with their lives, leave their birth certificates behind. The State of Israel then passed a law that only those Arabs who are able to prove their citizenship are allowed to return to their land, now known as Israel, which meant these 400,000 Arabs could not return and lost all the property they had left there. Ashkenazi Jew, David Ben-Gurion, one of the father founders of Israel and its first prime minister, candidly describes Jewish aims in his diary entry of May 21 as follows: "The Achilles heel of the Arab coalition is the Lebanon. Muslim supremacy in this country is artificial and can easily be overthrown. A Christian state ought to be set up there, with its southern frontier on the River Litani. We would sign a treaty of alliance with this state. Thus, when we have broken the strength of the Arab Legion and bombed Amman, we could wipe out Transjordan. After that Syria would fall. And if Egypt still dared to make war on us, we would bomb Port Said, Alexandria and Cairo. We should thus end the war and would have put paid to Egypt, Assyria and Chaldea on behalf of our ancestors." On October 1, Commander Anton Muller and his second-in-command, Emil Lackaut, send the following memo from Vienna to all interested parties. Military Police Service Circular Letter No. 31/48. Vienna.